So as Cynthia mentioned, I do currently research with laying hens and dairy cattle, but I began my scientific career studying parakeets. I moved to gerbils. I've done pigs, all kinds of cattle, cats and dogs, and a little bit of horses as well. And occasionally I get to sneak in a collaboration with a zoo species, so that's pretty fun. As well as doing different species, we do a variety of different techniques in the lab, and I'll kind of share some experiences from our lab, but also what I've done here is kind of put together a review of some really different approaches that people have taken to look at animal welfare and what can possibly be used in a zoo setting as well from that. So you guys are a day and a half into this already, so by now this should be firmly drummed into your head that animal welfare is multidisciplinary in nature, right? Involves biological functioning, where we assess things like the heart rate, the body temperature, the respiration rate of different animals, and really look at the physical functioning, the health. We're also talking a lot about the behavioral integrity, the natural living conditions of the animals. What behaviors should they show normally? What environments do they normally live in? And how do we best provide those? And then the affective states of the animals as well. So what are they feeling? What are their emotional internal lives like as they go through these environments and experiences? So all of these are really critical. And so when you try to go about talking about welfare, you need to either understand the limitations of your maybe single approach study, or you really need to try and encompass all of those kinds of broad things. And so when you're assessing or potentially enhancing welfare of the animals in your care, should keep that in mind, that it's not just one single element of the animal responding, it's the animal as a whole being. So in the past, our traditional measures have very much been about physical health, about the performance of the animal, and of course for me doing laying hens and dairy cattle, we're talking about milk often, and we're talking about eggs, but in the zoo world you may talk about the number of live young that are born, the number of years in captivity, etc. Physiology. Lots of us know the stress physiology literature, looking at cortisol as kind of a classic measure. And then behavior of animals, of course. And that's something that many of us in our interactions with animals find very intuitive. Now we're getting a bit more complicated too, because we've got a lot of advances in sciences like neuroscience, endocrinology, psychology, immunology, that are giving us other ways to ask questions of animals. Now a lot of these techniques though are fairly intensive, and so they require a lot of lab work, they may require some controlled studies initially, and so they're not always practical either on a production environment or in a zoo setting. But we are starting to learn a lot on the basic side of things from these techniques. And so we get a much more complex picture now. We're seeing more inside the animal, not just the surface. So we can now see how do the animal's bodies respond, but now we're really starting to dig into how their minds respond as well, okay? Because we can ask questions at the level of neuroscience or affective kinds of states. And traditionally, we've often focused on aversive situations, pain, suffering, discomfort. And now we're starting to ask questions about how animals respond to pleasure as well. For a long time, it was very taboo to even say that out loud, to say that animals experienced pleasure or happiness or things like that. And this is becoming much more standard. So good life has to be thought about in terms of welfare from the perspective of the animal. What are they seeing and hearing? What are they smelling? What are the vibrissae of these otters here able to detect? What is their perception of the world around them? And this can really inform us when we think about how does the animal cope with potentially something negative in its environment, and then how is the animal to actually able to adapt positively? What do they learn and use to manipulate and learn how to do well in their environment? So again, not just the negative side, but the positive side as well here. And then again, going beyond just the basic health and functioning physically of the animal to how the animal feels about what it's doing, what it's experiencing, et cetera. Those are key components. So you've heard a little bit about assessment from some earlier speakers today, but just to kind of recap a little bit, practical approaches in the farm animal world involve a lot of both animal and design-based measures. And so what I mean by that, for design-based measures, we're looking at the environment often that surrounds the animal, and this can involve the management as well. How much space per animal? What's the ambient temperature? What's the airflow like, the air quality? What's the flooring? How many times a day are you feeding them, et cetera. So you're really looking at what's being done around the animal or to the animal. And then we can actually look at the outcomes from the animals themselves. So how does the animal respond to the situation that they are in? Okay, what's the health of the animal? What behaviors are the animals doing? How are they functioning in those environments? And what we see in more recent years is that there's a tendency to shift toward the animal-based measures. The design-based measures are certainly easier to take, right? We can measure square footage and airflow and all of that stuff really easily. But we see people now looking at the animal-based measures because this is a direct statement, basically, of how the animal is responding to the situation, okay? You're seeing how the animal is processing everything and then either faring well or not faring well. So sometimes when we observe just the environmental sides of things, you have to make some assumptions about how those things connect. Now, there are cases where you always have, let's say, this amount of space leading to this animal outcome. And when you have really clear, consistent connections like that, then you can maybe have made your measure validated, and now you can just use the design-based measure. But in any case where you don't have a clear validation of a design-based measure, an animal measure may be the better. So here's some examples of some animal-based measures that I'm talking about. On the production side of things, for years, of course, farmers would look at things like body condition score, lesions and injuries. We're starting to ask more questions about gait. How well does the dairy cow or the pig or the broiler chicken walk? Health measures, of course, have been the province of the veterinarian. Is the animal urinating and defecating? Is the animal coughing or sneezing or showing eye discharge or things of that nature? And of course, eating and drinking is always a standard that we all look to, right? I mean, if you take your own animal to the vet, take a sick child or whatever to the vet, one of the first questions is, are they eating and drinking normally? So that's pretty standard. The use of vocalizations as welfare indicators is gaining a lot of ground as we learn more and more about what specific vocalizations may mean. So are these vocalizations just general, or are they very specific to certain situations? And we can do assessments of comfort. One of the things that's fairly standard to do in the dairy cow world is to do a cow comfort index, where you look at how many cows are touching a stall, and of those cows touching the stall, who's lying in it versus standing in it. And if you have lots more cows lying down, then you have a comfortable stall surface. And if all your cows are just kind of standing around, you might have a problem. So we have some other things that we look at fairly routinely on the behavior side. Stereotypies stand out for everyone, whether you're in the farm world, the lab world, the dog and cat world, or in the zoo world. Those things come across. Instances of aggression, too, because there's often consequences for the animals that are experiencing the aggression. We don't often look as much, though, on the positive side for things like play and grooming as things that we standardize and really kind of count to assess that the animals are doing well. Exploration and other kinds of affiliative behaviors can also be indicators of positive welfare. And I'll talk more about some of these in detail. And reactivity to humans is a big one as well. I know on the zoo side, there's been a lot of work looking at the impact of visitors on animals, but the impact of keepers on animals is also critical, and we see that on the production side as well. So here's a lot of animal-based measures that can be put into play. As I mentioned, it's really critical to validate whatever measure you're making, right? You can't just make an assumption that your measure means what you think it does. And my example here is the curious case of cortisol. So we know cortisol is the stress hormone, right? But most of us know that it's a bit more complicated than that because animals experience increases in cortisol when they do things like this. What's this? Courtship, yes, by everybody's favorite bird, right? At least mine. I love these guys. So courtship, you know, courtship may be a little stressful, but mostly we assume that this is sort of a pleasurable activity, right? Except maybe during high school. What do we have here? Playing, okay? So play behavior. We consider this like the ultimate of pleasurable, one of the ultimates of pleasurable behaviors, and cortisol goes up when you play. And here may be the ultimate pleasurable behavior, I don't know. So we have mating in the Wanako here. So, but cortisol goes up in all three of these cases, right? And so if you were to just look at a physiological profile of any of these animals, you'd probably see increased heart rate, increased respiration, increased body temperature, and increased cortisol. And so you might be thinking you had a stress response unless you looked in context, okay? So it's critical to keep context in mind, and it's critical to make your assessments at the right time. Now, as we get more complicated and start thinking about animal welfare as multidisciplinary, and we start taking a behavior measure here, a physiology measure here, maybe a neural measure here, one of the things that we found in these kind of more complex studies is that the measures sometimes contradict. So you may see the cortisol going up like we just saw in these past cases, but the context of the behavior seems really positive, okay? So you may end up with cases where you have these contradictions. Some of this might be due to the nature of the stressor, okay? So some things will stress some animals out more than others, and so you may see variations in the profile. How long did the stressor last? Is it an acute stress? Is it a chronic stress? And when exactly are you taking your measurements? Because let's say cortisol might take 15 minutes to peak in the bloodstream. So if you sample too soon or too late, you might have missed the peak entirely. Okay. The behavior measure, let's say if you're castrating a lamb, you may need to focus really intensely on those first 2 hours. And then you'll see some responses, but they peter out as they go along. So you have to be really careful with your timing, and sometimes the timing of sampling requires validation too. And then, of course, animals have just as many individual characteristics as we do. What's their physiological state? Is it a lactating or a pregnant female? What's the temperament of an animal? Is it a shy or a bold animal? Have they seen this before, or is it completely novel? So you have all of these complicated things that come into each individual animal, just like with us. And so I may love the roller coaster, and you may hate the roller coaster. And the animals may react very, very similarly. And of course, differences in age or in sex, breed, and species. Working in the laying hen industry, we have some laying hens that are more prone to cannibalism. Others never show that kind of behavior. So you have all kinds of variations that are possible. You can go on and list a lot of different things. And so you have to try and kind of sometimes tease out why you might be seeing contradictions, et cetera. Okay, so here's some specific examples of some different kinds of things you can do. So this is a very formal type of preference test here, where you present the animal with two very distinct choices. In this case, for bedding, we have wood chips under A and straw under B. And you give the animal the opportunity to choose either of those test chambers. And what do you like? What do you choose? How much time do you spend with each? And what do you do while you're in there with those situations? So you could do that with bedding. You could give them different social choices. Do you prefer to spend time with a group of females or with a group of males, et cetera? And so this has been done for a variety of different species, including zoo animals. And here's a great fish example. And in the practical world, I used to do a lot of companion animal behavior therapy. One of the biggest problems you see with cats is inappropriate elimination. So we often tell owners to do what we call the litter smorgasbord, where you basically give them the option to say, okay, try a bunch of different types of litters, one per cat box, and see what your cat chooses. Try different litter box styles. Maybe you have a closed box cat, maybe you have an open box cat. And put them in different locations around the house. And you mess with all those variables and change them around. It starts to look a lot like what you guys do in the zoos and your enclosures, right? So you do this at home in the companion animal world as well. You can do space and resource use assessments. And this is kind of an informal type of preference testing. And this, again, happens a lot in the zoo world, where you can either do live or video recorded observations of where are the animals spending time. Is it located next to a particular resource, or is it located a particular distance from the visitor's viewing area? What is potentially causing the animal to make those choices? But in addition to doing the live observations, which can be pretty time intensive, the other option is to use technology to do this for you. So sometimes you can put GPS trackers on animals in large open field settings, or you can do, we've got some sensors that we're working on at Michigan State, where the sensors react with other stationary sensors to tell you where the animal is relative to your stationary sensors. So you can do either tech-heavy or tech-light kinds of studies for this. And if you look in the Journal of Zoo Biology, I did a really quick search on space use. And I think I turned up over 800 different articles, everything ranging from tree frogs to okapi, and then also on the human side, from the visitors to the keepers, looking at space use and how they were using space. So you can ask the vital questions about where the animal is and what is it doing while it's there. What are the features that it either likes or dislikes? So you can use these kinds of sort of practical applied field studies of preference to get an idea of the appropriateness of the environment and the resources, what your animal prefers or avoids, And then you can tweak what's going on out there to see if you can, well, they're never using this corner of the exhibit, but they really like the hay over there, so do we scatter some hay over here? So you can try and make some changes in response. Operant responding is something that you kind of think of the Skinner box here. We've got a pigeon and a rat both in a Skinner box. The animal learns to press a lever to get a pellet or some grain reward. And this is very formal, but you can also have this in a much less formal kind of situation. We've often used these situations to see how much does an animal want something, or what can an animal see. The goat in this corner here was being assessed for visual perception. What kinds of shapes and colors could goats see? And they actually have quite a nice range. So in addition, though, to these formal tests, you can do animals on farm or in zoos. And we do this actually to them all the time without thinking about it. Think about the kinds of drinkers that we present animals with, either Lixit types of tubes or bowls where they have to press to get water. That's an operant responding. They do that all the time. Their behavior with an outcome. Flaps to access the indoor versus the outdoor exhibit. Changing their position in an exhibit, so control over their physical location. But here's something different. Here we have a dog that's been trained to turn on a light for a person who can't. Well, what if the dog was able to just turn on the light because it wanted more light? Or you were able to turn the thermostat up if you were a pig and you wanted to be warmer? So we might be able to give animals some methods of controlling things on their own. This little video here shows a dog that uses this panel to ask for something specific. He keeps pushing the same one. He's like, no, this one. He wanted the kibble. In another video clip from that, he pushes a different one and he wants to go on a walk. So he learned to associate each of those different symbols with a different thing that dogs like, and he would ask specifically for something. So you can actually teach a dog to ask for specifically what he wants, not just to sit there and whine at you. Okay, so you can do that. And probably, you know, other animals would be good at that as well. So there's some ideas out there that you can use rewarded instrumental learning to basically enhance animal welfare. And you guys do this a lot with the different kinds of training to get animals to present for exams so that you don't have to anesthetize, okay? But here's a horse who's learned to have some control over its environment. She doesn't want to be in the stall anymore. There she goes.
Here she comes.
Let's see if I can, there, we'll turn her off. The owner's a little excited. But so this horse, and she's in a fully enclosed and safe paddock when she gets out, but she knows how to let herself out of the stall when she feels like it. So we give animals some control, and we know psychologically that both animals and humans really, really like this. Here's an example of stationing in feral cats for feeding to reduce aggression. So again, operant responding to improve behavior. And then we can also use operant responding to provide cognitive enrichment. And there's some really nice examples that, though wild zoos are providing enrichment to animals, they're not always stimulating them mentally, but animals may want that. We see some animals that actually will work when things are available for free because they'd rather have that stimulation. So that may be to their benefit. And here's an example of animals that learned to use a maze to get back to the sow to nurse. And they were much less fearful later in life, and they were better at solving a spatial task. So you have those kinds of different examples to improve welfare. Okay. Now, I'm in great danger of running over myself, so I'm going to stop here. And during questions and Q&A time, ask me about this part. Okay? So, since I'm the moderator, I will be good and finish myself now and let my next speaker have enough time.